Good day, podcast friends, and welcome to Reality TV Wrap-Ups. My name is Jessica Leese, and I've got some really super extra special coverage for you. That's right, by popular demand, we are going to be spending a little bit of time today talking about The Amazing Race Australia. It's the only amazing race that we may get for a very good long while, and I know that we're all starved for anything amazing race. Even if we did just wrap up the US version, we need more. And boy, did they bring more. This is the most unique Amazing Race experience that I have seen in quite a while. And I'm very excited to talk about all of the ups and downs of the first 2 weeks of this experience so far. And of course, I can't do this all on my own. So I brought with me one of my favorite Amazing Race experts. You know him from the Amazing Race Canada podcast, as well as his own very excellent Tomorrow Society podcast. Please welcome to the stage a man who could eat 40 dry wheat Bix and not even break a sweat, Mr. Dan Heaton.
Hello, Jess. I am excited. I feel like I've been just living the Amazing Race with so many episodes, so many teams, and so many tasks. It's like it's overload. I don't know what to think of it.
It's like we always ask for a little bit more, and Amazing Race Australia is like, what? What? You say more? Okay, here's more. And it's a lot. It's a lot. And of course, Dan, I really feel like the two of us could have a great time talking about this, but there would be something missing, and we would be rightly called to the carpet for not having an actual Australian to break down an Australian television program. And so we have brought one with us. And so, all the way from Sydney, Australia, you know her from many awesome guest spots on various podcasts throughout the RHAP universe. And most recently, I believe she is recapping Bridgerton for the Post Show Recaps patrons. A member of the RHAP class of 2020 is Sarah Carradine.
Oh, good afternoon. Or g'day, as I should say. Well, I don't say, but a lot of people say. Thanks very much, guys. First, I'd like to start by acknowledging that I live and work in the place we now call Sydney, Australia. The original custodians of this land are the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I acknowledge the elders past, present, and emerging, and I further acknowledge that this land was never ceded.
Okay, Sarah, and I really love this. I love this expression. I love this acknowledgement, and it does call to mind the warning that comes up, or the message that comes up at the beginning of every episode of Amazing Race Australia. So I think there must be a cultural push now to be acknowledging these lands and their original occupants. Is that correct? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
That's absolutely right. And I was very pleased to see, and it's absolutely right that the acknowledgement of country comes up on as text at the beginning of every episode. And if you just wanted a quick breakdown, what it is the welcome to country, which you'll see in many of the episodes. So a person whose country you are on, one part of the original custodians, it may be an elder, will welcome you to their country. And for those of us for those of us who are on other people's country, we do an acknowledgement of country to say, I know I'm on your country. I acknowledge that it's yours. And particularly now we also say never ceded, because the lands were not ceded. But I find it a very joyful and happy thing to do, and I'm really happy to do it. And what I love, and I'm sure we'll get into it, in many of the episodes that we've seen so far, you'll see a welcome to country. And that means someone who is originated on that land will welcome the people to the land, and they say, you are safe. You are safe in my country. And please, you know, enjoy yourselves.
Wow, that's really beautiful. And I really appreciate having more of the background on that. I feel like I have learned so much about Australia, even though, you know, I've seen 4 other seasons of Amazing Race Australia. This is a very unique experiment for several reasons that I think we might as well kick off our discussion by talking about some of the ways that this is a different series from the other series that have aired so far. And I want to tell all the listeners up front that we are probably going to discuss plot points that have happened up through season 6, not season six, episode six, up through episode six. And then we are going to speculate on some things we've heard about episode seven. However, we're not going to give you an episode by episode breakdown because we would be here. It is 1 p.m. in Sydney and 9 p.m. in New York, and we would be here until it is, you know, 9 p.m. in Sydney and whatever god awful time it is in New York at that point. So we're not going to do that, but we are going to try to give you a little overview of the season so far and talk a little bit about the overarching themes and differences that we've noticed. And so to start that off, I want to talk about the logistics behind the filming of this season and the decision to keep the race in Australia. As we know, like, there's not a lot of travel going on, which is kind of suicide for a travel show, but it's not unprecedented either. As Dan and I have been covering for many, many years now, actual years, the Amazing Race Canada, it is another franchise that has done this kind of hyper local race situation. And Dan, I wondered, how does this compare so far?
You know, in some ways it's similar, but to me, it feels very different. And it might just be because we've watched enough Amazing Race Canada seasons that I'm kind of used to how they kind of run that show. And this feels different to me just because, too, like, they've spent so much time in a fairly small area. You know, so far, all the first six episodes have been in Queensland, and they've moved along. They've gone to different places within that. They've gone to islands. They've been the rainforest is where they started. But everything seems really local. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but there's even been tasks where, like, the walking around with the outhouse, the toilets, you know, and I apologize, I forgot the exact name, but that one's so much fun. And you have all the locals sitting out and cheering them on. Are they dancing on the beach? There just seems to be so much interaction with people in each area. You know, they're going and serving drinks to people that aren't even involved with the show. So there's a lot of things like that. And I think that makes it feel a little different, where Amazing Race Canada, especially the most recent time when they stayed in the country, felt a little more like, well, it's kind of like normal Amazing Race, but it's in Canada, where this felt like something kind of different, where it's like they're having them do all kinds of goofy things, but it also, there's a little bit of fun to it, which it doesn't feel as stilted maybe as sometimes it can be if you don't travel much.
I'm glad that you like it, Dan, because that was something I noticed and I found really delightful, was the involvement of the locals, whether to, you know, get a free beer from someone who's delivering it incorrectly, or there was a whole group of people pointing at a clue that people had missed. I found that actually really delightful.
Yeah, it's an interesting pivot. I think the original point of Amazing Race Canada was to say Canadians travel all over the world, but most of them don't know what's in their own country. And let's showcase it in a way, like, make it Amazing Race, but make it, you know, put the whole world in Canada. And here, this is very much, it feels like it's by Australians for Australians. It's like, we're stuck at home, so let's just celebrate at home.
Yeah, I totally agree. Oh, I totally agree, because, like, even you see, like, the restaurants with the big $12 lunch signs. I mean, everything just feels so local. And I don't mean that as negative. I'm not trying to say, oh, it's just like if you had one in your own city. They're traveling, but they're able to take some time and go to a lot of kind of different places in each area and spotlight the areas, which, to me, who has never been to Australia, it's really fun.
I think one of the things I thought I would miss prior to seeing it was the wonderful language barriers and problems of traveling overseas, the unfamiliarity with public transport in Seoul or wherever you might be, unfamiliarity with the money and so on. So I thought, oh, I'm going to miss that. But the replacement of the locals begging for help on the street, as some of them do, and I think too, judges that are actually judging the tasks rather than being given the nod by production, I think almost or fully makes up for that.
Yeah, it is. It makes me want to travel to it, even if it doesn't feel like it would be a vacation. It feels like you'd be visiting friends almost. It's a subtle distinction, I think, but an important one. But Sarah, one of the things I really wanted to hear about, we, of course, here in the States, and some of this is probably review for the for our Australian listeners, but here in the States, we've had a lot of different experiences with regard to the COVID pandemic and how TV shows have gotten made despite the various lockdowns and state regulations and how much people are allowed to go out and quarantine and whatnot. But no, I know that one of the reasons that we have only seen, you know, we've seen six entire legs in one state is that it also varies from state to state in Australia. So I wonder if you could speak to a little bit to what has the COVID pandemic been like in Australia and how did that inform how they had to film this series?
Well, that's a big question. Let me just start by saying that in Sydney, in New South Wales, we've been very lucky. We've had some mask mandates and we're pretty obedient here. For a group of rowdy rebels and scallywags, we're actually quite obedient. So our counts have been fairly low. We have a smaller population, but even by percentage of population, some states have had a hard lockdown and have had a much harder time than us. Victoria, in particular, had a restriction of a 5-kilometre radius for going out for a really long time. We had, here in Sydney, we had obviously restaurants were closed and various things, but we have the beaches, we have the sea, we have a lot of places outside that we could still go. West Australia, which is in the west of the country, a great big state on the left-hand side, is still the borders are closed, I think, or you can get through with a permit, which is why I believe the Amazing Race won't be going to Western Australia. And Tasmania, which is the little island down the bottom of Australia, has had hard borders as well. It's very interesting because I knew Australia had different states, of course I did, but I never thought about that idea of crossing borders the way you think about it from the 1940s in Europe, you know, trying to get over borders, spies, passports, trains and various things, because we've travelled very freely. But with COVID and borders being closed, Queensland was closed for a while with permits. It's been an interesting way to think about the country. I think production has done really well. They filmed in October and November when the numbers were looking fairly good. And I did notice that they were wearing Amazing Race masks at one of the airports. And I thought, oh, I want one of those. But on the other hand, Bo, who I'm sure we might have one or two things to say about, is a very huggy man. He hugs a lot of people, including our wonderful Olympic swimmer, C-Bomb, gave her a great whacking hug on the mat. And I thought, dude, there's a pandemic going on. But perhaps it's his nature. So there's not really a definitive answer for you. I think we're kind of slightly pleased with ourselves that we've done well. We could have done better. We had a very early, huge problem with a cruise ship that came in and people were allowed to disembark. And from Sydney, they went to almost all the other states and took COVID with them. And this was why I think there was a instant and quite hard reaction, because we saw it spreading so quickly and restrictions came in seemingly overnight and they were quite severe. But it has, you know, it's had a good effect, I think. But I'd also like to say nobody asked for this. Like, nobody in the world asked for this. So people are just doing their best. Except for Bo, hugging people.
Yeah, except for Bo. Bo could probably use some work.
Yeah.
And I like especially how it feels like this season has tried to turn a lemon into lemonade in a lot of great ways. Or I don't know. It tried to turn its weird vegetable matter into Vegemite. I don't know what the Australian equivalent of that is. Maybe you guys just have lemonade. And they're treating this almost as like an experimental lab, because this is a wildly different experience Amazing Race wise, at least as far as the English language Amazing Race adaptations go. And we'll get to that, I think. But Dan, I think we're going to start with the actual scope and size of this. We are getting 3 episodes a week, and there are 24 legs of The Amazing Race for this season. How are you taking that? How do you like it so far?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, it was a bit of a scramble to watch everything in time, and the episodes are longer too. A lot of them are without commercials or anything are like 1 hour and 8 minutes, except for the last few. So the thing is, I've noticed this because I've watched a lot of Australian Survivor, and even last season, they kind of did a similar thing with the first season with Bo. But this season does feel very different than that season, which that season felt a little bit like Amazing Race Around the World light, like it was, they were doing a lot of the hits. This time, I kind of like it because, again, you know, you do kind of the think tanks when you watch a show and you're like, well, what if they had this weird twist, or what if they did this? That'd be kind of crazy. And because they have so much time, they're just going to try all kinds of and I don't just mean the tasks. I mean, some of the things we're going to talk about, the devices. I mean, bringing a team back that got eliminated. The penalties are weird. There's a lot of weird stuff, but I feel like because it's so long and because it's so different, I don't feel like it's as bad in a way, because I'm like, well, this is kind of like you said, like a science experiment. It's like, let's just try a lot of different stuff and see what happens. And plus, we have a lot of fun teams. So I'm okay spending time with most of these teams for a long time.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, there's always that one guy on Reddit who will post like, I have an idea for a twist. And then he posts like a 1500 word essay explaining the most Byzantine complicated thing that will never play on television. And I feel like maybe Amazing Race Australia was reading that like, hey, hire that guy. He's got ideas.
There's certainly some wild things that happen. But as you say, because the episodes are so long, you think by the time you've reacted to that, there's something else coming down the line to react to. So it is a little bit of a, not so much a roller coaster, but perhaps a tinny going up a river and seeing various different things on either side.
All right, stop down, Sarah. What's a tinny?
A tinny, well, this is the very first thing that they do. They have a choice of beach or boat, and they either do, they either run down the sand, which I don't know if anyone's done sand running. It is hard. Or they were able to jump into a tinny. And a tinny is any small boat with an outboard motor.
Right. Yeah. And one of the things, I know you were really excited to be on here, so you could stop down and help us explain some of these things.
Absolutely.
And I don't think it doesn't feel like I'm watching a show in a foreign language, to be honest. And I have watched Amazing Race in languages I do not speak. So maybe I'm just attuned to that. But Sarah, this is not unusual for Australian reality TV. Am I right? You people like to watch 3 episodes of something a week for 2 months.
Do we like to watch it, or are we required to watch it?
Well, they keep doing it to you, so you must not hate it.
Well, I guess, look, there is something about, you know, watching our own reality shows that we like doing, you know, and dissecting them and talking about them and, you know, seeing representation. 3 nights a week, it is a commitment, but if you love the show, you'll want to watch it. That's what they're counting on anyway.
I will say that doing it this way, especially for like doing a podcast, is it's almost like binge watching a show, where I feel like if we just watched like 2 episodes, or we watched these 6, but we watched them in 6 weeks, I'd be thinking, now what happened at week 2 or 1 or 3? Where now I'm like, it's all just kind of roped together in one big, all the stuff that I watched in like the past 6 days or something. So it's fresh in the brain, where it would be harder for me to remember leg 1 if we were 5 weeks from now.
It's almost like we watched two very, very long, like 4.5-hour episodes.
Basically.
Yes, I mean, I think they did that with Survivor as well, that the groupings of themes almost within a week, within your three episodes of a week, they are like a long arc. And I think that, the editors have to be given really good credit for that. So something that begins as a nod or a handshake in one episode, three episodes later, they're sharing a taxi. So you can they're doing those sort of mini narrative threads throughout it. As I understand, the number of episodes, both with Survivor and with this, is probably to do with the advertisers, you know, boldly. The money's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I will say that's not totally unprecedented. I am going to look up the exact number, but I have seen some of the Israeli version of The Amazing Race, and they also tend to spend a lot of time in one place. And they will mostly divide up the legs into several episodes. So you see like many, 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 many more minutes of the exact same leg. So it's basically three episodes to a leg. And they average around 34, 35 episodes in a season. So it's not unprecedented to have this many episodes. But it is, again, it's a commitment.
That really is a commitment.
Yeah. So, I mean, so what do you both of you think of the teams? Because I feel like the seasons of Australian Survivor that I've enjoyed the most are the ones where I like the people the most. The ones that have felt like, oh my gosh, have been the few where I felt like they weren't as interesting. So I feel like this is going to work or not work based on the teams that we have and whether we like or somehow just marvel at because they're crazy. But so what do you think of the teams? Do you like them? Do you like the overall group pretty well?
Well, first of all, 28 people is too many to keep track of.
Yes.
I have a figure of 30,000 as the number of people who auditioned.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the number of people who were on the show. Well, that tracks.
Feels very much like they didn't cut many out. I mean, Wikipedia says that, who knows, but let's say that it was 30,000. That's a lot of people. We're down to 28. It took me a while to distinguish some of them from each other, but I immediately had my favorites and they've stayed true. The ones that haven't been eliminated have stayed through all through six legs.
All right, so who you got, Sarah?
Zephyr.
Who's your favorite?
Jessica.
Woo!
Oh.
Zephyr.
Yeah, come over here on the, you know, come over here and sit with me because they're my favorite people.
I love them so much.
I love them so much. So Zephyr, for those of you who are listening to us rather than watching the show, first of all, what are you doing? Go and watch it. but for those of you who aren't, Zephyr is from Tonga. He is a personal trainer, and his best friend is Jessica, who was born in Western Samoa and came to Australia when she was 14. Like many of us, they're from somewhere else. A lot of Australians are from somewhere else, which goes back to the acknowledgement and the welcome. And they are, I can't get enough of them. I absolutely can't get enough of them. Because I rewatched, I noticed that one of the very first confessionals, and it might have been the first, was Jessica and Zephyr. So I think the show loves them as well. Jessica was worried about her fitness before she came on the race, but she was the one that said, let's do the sand running because the tinny, the little boat, is deceiving. So she's really smart because she looked at the two things and she thought, getting into a boat and being driven to your cars or running a kilometre on sand, it seems like the boat would be easier, but that's not going to be the case. And in fact, she was right because all the people who did the sand run got to the task first. And so right from the start, we see her strategic mind and her thinking. But quite apart from anything else, she's absolutely hilarious and she won't have a bar of Delore, who we will get to. Jessica, what do you like about them?
Well, apart from, you know, you have to stan a team that's got a Jessica on it.
Well, of course.
I think you have covered it. I think my very favorite
recurring theme so far has been the rivalries between Holly and Delore and Sepha and Jess, and also to some extent the mums earlier, but it was like they passed the torch when they got eliminated, and Jess just picked it up and ran with it. And every time they're on camera with Delore, she is dunking on him viciously, and it's so glorious.
And also he won't learn. He was admiring his partner, Holly, doing an endurance task. And he said, oh, Holly, you know, Holly has more endurance than I do. And she, Jessica just says deadpan, you know, every woman does, bro. It's like, don't keep setting her up, Delore. He doesn't see her as a threat and he doesn't see her as his equal. And so he continually just walks bang straight into her wonderful wit and scorn, and it's delightful television.
It absolutely is. I want them to be on screen together for a very long time, and I think, yeah, we do have to talk about Holly and Delore, because I think this is a team we have seen many, many times on the show in the past, and we've even seen them on Amazing Race Australia. I've gotten, you know, we got that vibe last year from the social media influencers, and it's just like they present as these like very intense, hyper-competitive people that argue with each other all the time, and, you know, they're going to do whatever it takes, and then the thing that I find the most intriguing about Holly and Delore is they're not actually very good at racing. And so I have to wonder, can you be an effective villain if you're not that good at the race?
They are the mildest of villains, is what I wrote down. Mm-hmm. Just the mildest of villains. One thing that's very hard to... So Holly and Delore slid into each other's DMs 5 years ago. She's a lawyer. He's related to the Nigerian royal family. And...
Well, I think one of his cousins emailed me the other day.
Yes.
He's got a business proposition for me.
Oh, yes. I get right on that. the thing about Holly does want the surprise proposal in Las Vegas in front of the fountains. So Delore certainly knows what's expected of him. My problem, what is less enjoyable about them than our influences from the last season, who I just loved. They were brilliant, and then they were hoist by their own petard of being penalised for breaking the rules, which they thought they could. The problem with Holly and Delore is they don't like each other. And so that makes it, I can't quite, while I relish Delore being dragged right, left and centre, and as we see as the legs go on now, everybody's in on the act. Holly and Delore as a pair just don't have that enjoyable factor that our villains last season did, because they actually don't like each other, and that's hard to watch. Dan, what do you think?
Well, to me though, it's so interesting, because one of my favorite moments of the whole season though is Delore before the synchronized swimming, where Delore is like so thinking that somehow you can synchronize swim in like 2 feet of water, and doesn't, and of course she's, and then blames her, which is not good, but him, he's like a cartoon character, but in a way not as fun as some cartoon characters. But I feel like she has her moments where she's, oh, I like the nice things or whatever, but she's actually a fairly decent racer for the most part and fairly smart. And he is just like a disaster. I mean, he's ridiculous. And of course also too, they brought a massager along on the trip, and there's like this one moment where Shane, which we might talk about a bit, gets removed medically, and they cut to like her massaging his back or something, and the editors are just dunking on them, like all their stuff about them not understanding why they got U-turned, and then talking bad about the other teams. I mean, there's just so much content, but I agree, I don't think they're going to last that much longer. Actually, I think the editors are like, we are going to get every minute out of this team. But I love Sepha and Jessica. One of the things I love the most too is just not only her making fun of him, but just her looking at, she has these looks that she gives Delore, like, what are you? You are ridiculous. Like, can't even like laugh, like almost like a Jim Halpern to the camera in The Office. Just ridiculous. But yeah, I don't know. I still enjoy Holly and Delore, but not because I think they're like a fun, likable team, more just because, like, even them getting the ridiculous car, of course, that's the, I mean, just everything. I mean, it's just silly that would happen.
They got the ridiculous car because he was looking at every car. They got to pick their cars. He looked at every car to find the automatic. And, of course, everybody else is just jumping in and driving off. And they ended up – so it was first in best dressed. I don't know if you guys use that expression. You ran and you just jumped into whatever car you could find from this group of cars. They ended up with the worst car because he was looking for an automatic because he went on the amazing race – Jessica, without what? Learning how to drive a manual? I mean, speechless.
Yeah, it's they're singularly unprepared. But here's the thing. I think Dad's going to laugh at this a lot because he knows it's true. If we had done a cast draft, which it's probably good we didn't because it would have taken us 4 hours with all of these people. But had we done a draft, Dan knows I would have picked them first.
Oh, yeah. You had Sid Nash right last season, I think, when we drafted, too. You know?
I did have Sid Nash, and these are like Sid Nash 2.0, and I would have snatched them up off the board as quickly as Dan would pick the strongest-looking young female team that would go out in a blaze of glory in episode 2.
That would have been a good choice, the strong female team this year, though, I would say.
Would have been
a great choice.
Yeah.
They're just breathing
Stopped
fire.
Clock is right. But stopped clock, right? Twice a day.
Hey. Dan, I think you make a good point. I am now thinking I would like to see Holly race without Delore. I think Holly with a different partner could be like really interesting. He's the one that complains. He's the one that blames everybody else. He is a brilliant on a scooter and then he can't ride a dirt bike. He can't swim. He screams. And she's there.
Yeah, I mean, she's a little less, she's a little quieter. So I don't know for the TV, but there's something. I will say as far as best teams, I think teams that are strongest, I would say for me, and I don't mean to switch it up, but I would say the Super Seeks seem very strong. And then of the rest, I'd say the Gold Coast girls, Ashley and Amanda, those two teams have been the most consistent. Everybody else, like the Cowboys are like a ping pong ball. I mean, some of the other teams are all over the place, but I don't know. What do you think? Are those teams the teams that are going to go far probably?
It seems like it. There's a lot of like rando teams, though. It's like, oh, I forgot you were even there. Like the Princess and Geek team, for instance, they show up and I'm like, oh, I guess they're still in it.
Yes, absolutely. I can't get them their names in my head. I was trying because I was coming on the podcast and I thought I should sound professional and know what they're called. I don't know what their story is. We're six legs in. I still don't know. He's a geek. She's a princess, and there doesn't seem to be anything else. Look, I'm sure they have a lovely relationship. They've been sweethearts since they were at high school, but I'm not sure what else. Whereas you look at Jaskara and Anurag, which are just the most beautiful names to say, the Super Seeks, and you get that complexity. They're already talking right from the start about we are raised as Sikhs to help and assist other people, yet we're on this race. So I think we often get in reality TV people saying, oh, look, I wouldn't do this normally, but it's the, you know, I wouldn't lie, but it's the game. But for them, it is actually a deep spiritual dilemma for them to not help people. They're certainly very strong. I think it's interesting, and we'll talk about the first class pass, which really did them a dirty. They get a leg off, but then have to pick their place out of a bag. Ashley and Amanda are fabulous. They're from the Gold Coast. There's a stereotype of girls from the Gold Coast, which they fit, but they also transcend. And I'm loving watching them racing. They're super smart and they're cunning as well, cunning in the most positive way. So yes, I agree. I do like them. We need to talk about Shane and Deb as well, Jess, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. We definitely do. I thought they were so strong in the beginning and it was so exciting to see a team that typically, and this is something I think is across the board is true of this cast. You really feel like pretty much anybody could win this whole thing and anybody is poised to do well. And you look at Shane and Deb, and this is a team that if they're cast for Amazing Race US or even Amazing Race Canada, they might win a leg. They might be up in front for a little while, but they don't seem like competitors. And it really, up until the point where they went out, it really felt like they could go all the way. And it was really great to see them hang with everybody else.
Yeah.
And then the way he went out was just heartbreaking.
To see a tent being cut off the top of someone was, very scary.
Yeah. And again, we can talk about, because Bo is Bo, we have to talk about like Bo closing the door on the ambulance and hitting it like it's a cab driving off. And it's just like, do you have an ounce of gravitas in your entire body, dude?
No, he doesn't. He really doesn't.
Yeah, that was a weird scene overall because they showed him and he was in such bad shape there was no Jeff Probst to come explain it and be like, okay, here's what's happening. Let me interview the doctor. I was like, wait, so I know they did that, the roadblock and his knee hurt, but he looks like he's like having some serious medical issues. And I mean, it was just strange. And that's the thing. They were dominant for three straight legs and could have won the leg that they lost right before that to the Cowboys. They got outrun at the very last second. So they could have won three legs in a row. And for him to lose because they did a survivor challenge in the middle of the race and had to do that is just kind of crazy the way it happened.
He did look very much as if he was having some kind of internal medical issue, but I believe it was he has a bad knee that's had a couple of operations, and having to hang off a pole over the water, I think just obviously inflamed it or damaged it in some way. And the reason they had to cut the tent off the top of him is he just simply couldn't move. But if you look at the medical people around him, they've packed his knee, and it didn't seem that they were concerned about, you know, heart or any other involvement.
Well, that's good to know, Sarah. Has there been any press coverage of this? Like, have they done exit interviews?
I haven't seen anything, but I can certainly have a quick look while we're talking.
Sure. And so while we're doing research on the fly,
sorry, I should have done that.
it's not an Amazing Race podcast if you're not like Googling stuff in the background. Like, how many times do we have like you can hear the typing happening? We can talk about some other people that really caught my eye. I think obviously the Cowboys are a lot of fun, and they really do remind me of the famous Cowboys from U.S. Amazing Race in that they are all over the map as far as how well they do, but they still seem to come out on top most of the time. And then I would also, I think kind of under the radar, and I'm really happy that things have shaken out the way they have, is Dwez and Catherine are great. He is so relentlessly positive and they're so happy to be there. I really respond to that and I enjoy watching them. And also, I want to hear more about Kimberly. I don't think they're going to go there this season, but I have just recently, I work in the travel industry and we used to go there. We don't anymore. And so I've been reading up on it and it just seems like an amazing place.
I just think they are fantastic. I was so sorry to see them go first. I mean, we say First Nations first, but we don't mean First Nations out first in the Amazing Race, I don't think.
And it's happened before, too.
Yeah. It was great to see them return, and either the other races were very good actors or they seemed genuinely pleased to have them back. I like their cheerfulness. I like their relationship. Now, they too also bicker, but unlike Holly and Delore, they clearly are extremely good friends and very close. So I hope that they do well. Now, here's something interesting that I wish I'd known before. It was a knee problem for Shane, and he's recovering. Now, we do remember that Deb a couple of times says she was recovering from breaking her leg earlier in the year. She says, after the show, I went and got another x-ray because it was feeling funny, and it was broken the whole way through. I did the show with a broken leg. So that's awesome. I mean, it's awful.
That is awesome. Surprisingly common on The Amazing Race.
Yeah,
I have heard multiple racers say in exit interviews, yeah, it turned out I had stress fractures in my legs from this experience, or I had an injury that I didn't know about that got aggravated. It's kind of shocking, like how much of a toll this takes on your body.
Look, I'm not surprised. Even just watching them do the sand running, because I'm a lifesaver at Bondi Beach, and sand running is just the absolute worst. It's really, really, it's very hard on you. But both are recovering, and I just thought they were fantastic. Their children told them that they weren't allowed to go up first, and they did considerably better than that. And I think, you know, conceivably could have been seen as race winners if it hadn't been for the medical evacuation.
Yeah, I was inclined to come in thinking, like, you know, when I was watching it, like, if I was going to say before that leg, who were the favorites, it would have been them and the Sikhs and the Gold Coast girls. And they were right there with them. They might have even been kind of a sentimental favorite to win it all. I did want to mention one team that got eliminated, mainly Jabel and Ronnie. Ronnie is wonderful, too. Such a sweet guy. They have such a good relationship. I was so happy. I wasn't happy Dwez and Catherine got eliminated, but when they had to take a penalty because they didn't understand how to do the bombs away challenge at all, and then survived because I thought they were done, and then have been real solid. I was sad, especially because they lost to Holly and Dolore at the end, but really enjoy them. They're so much fun.
I love their relationship, and they kept saying over and over again, "Now look, we just have to be smart and not get lost," and then they'd get lost or leave their lantern up a mountain, or the fact that they were done in at the end by not being able to swim is it just the way it is. I mean, the cowboys aren't good in the water either. We always think of Australians being swimmers. I'm a swim coach as well, so I only teach adults, and there are a lot of people who have had a terrible fright in the water and need to be, you know, carefully taught to swim again and to be confident, or people who haven't grown up on the beach and haven't grown up swimming and get to adulthood, or they may be migrants or refugees, and they want to take part in Australian life. And those are often the people that I'm teaching in the water, and it's really rewarding. And here we have someone who grew up in the Philippines not swimming, and it's all very well to say, "Oh, you're on the Amazing Race, go and learn to swim." It's a little bit different from saying, "You're on the Amazing Race, go and get in a manual car." That's a transferable skill, whereas swimming is something quite different. I was very worried for him when he was in the water, because I could see him doing what we call climbing the ladder. And it's when people are basically panicked and checked out in the water, and they make motions with their hands and legs. I'm doing it now. That looks like ladder climbing. And I thought he's in real trouble. But of course, they had water safety there to help him.
Mm-hmm. That's a thing. That's why if you are not a trained lifeguard, you shouldn't necessarily try to pull someone out who's drowning, because they will pull you under with them, correct?
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, when you go into the water to bring someone out who's panicking, you swim towards them or use the IRB, which is the inflatable boat. But if you swim towards them or go on a board, you always turn before you get them, and you put your one leg out towards them so they can't reach you. You're kind of holding them at bay with your foot. And just a quick tip, if anyone does pull you down, the way to get out of it is you go down and push them up, and they will let you go.
See, we learned something today on the Amazing Race.
Well, I was thrilled to see my five hole when they were on the Gold Coast doing the lifeguard signaling challenge.
Yeah, how accurate was that? Did they comport themselves well?
Well, who knows what Dolore was doing?
Because whoever knows.
I mean, he said, "Oh, well, I'll just do this and hopefully she gets it." No, no, you have to read the clue. You pick up your binoculars. You look at your map just like everybody else. I have to say one of the dancers said it's the most challenging challenge. And it was a very challenging challenge. It's quite tough to signal. So, again, they were using correct signaling with the flags. The break was quite big, and the partner who was in the IRB, the inflatable rescue boat, had to go between buoys, or buoys as you guys call them, to collect numbered flags. It was actually, I thought it was a surprisingly challenging challenge, and I was really pleased with them, as were they, when they managed to figure it out.
Yeah, it was weird. One of the very small differences between American English and Australian English was hearing them talking about going out to the boys in the water. And I'm like, did they really put people out in the water? You know, let alone like very young children. This seems unsafe, but no, they actually meant what we would call buoys.
What you would call buoys, yes.
Yes.
And those boats are kind of slightly terrifying to be in because they do go off the back of a wave and they slam down on the water behind. Mm-hmm. So they're quite hard to be in. You see them holding onto that safety strap. So I thought it was quite amazing that they all got through. I thought that was a challenging challenge and amazing that they got through it, but they did.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges, especially with regard to the way that penalties are treated, which completely shocks me. And I'm sure that Dan had some feelings about this as well. You get a 30-minute penalty for quitting a task. That is insane to me, having seen U.S. Amazing Race give somebody a 24-hour penalty for quitting a task, and Amazing Race Canada routinely dishing out 2 hours and 4 hours. So how do we feel about how they're using penalties, and do we think that people are going to start quitting tasks strategically?
It's really interesting because I think about that first episode when Jabel and Ronnie couldn't do the task and they were already near the back because they got lost. I was like, well, they're done. That's 2 hours. They have no chance. And then they got there and it was only 30 minutes. I went, what? And then there were other tasks. I mean, some of them were, you know, you had Milan and Tina breaking the dinosaur or something. But even the big one where Duez and Catherine get in, they hitch a ride and only get 10 minutes. And I was like, that's nothing. So it's weird because some of these tasks, like if all of them are really 30 minutes, I mean, you're probably not thinking about it when you're in it. Maybe they're different. I would be like, go up. If I'm like near the front of the pack, I'd be like some of them, the detours have to be different. Cause like that radio one or like when you had to eat all those dry food, I'd be like, oh, you're going to give me 30 minutes. I'm going to go right past that. Is there some difference? Because that's what I think. In one sense, I like it because it creates drama. Like if it was 2 hours, they'd be done. And Amazing Race Canada, even when it's 2 hours, sometimes it flips around, but other times it's not. So I like that part of it from a TV perspective, but from like a race strategy perspective, to me, I feel like there's got to be some that are more, because if not, you know, there's a limit. You can't just go in and skip every task. You have to try them or something. I don't know what it would be.
Do you think that they know what the time penalty is? Because I think Rani and Jabel certainly tried to do the bombing task. Like, we're celebrating being bombed by the Japanese in 1942 with this challenge. But did they, I mean, I wonder, did they know? Can they ask, you know, if we stop, what will our challenge, what will our, excuse me, penalty be? Is it based on, had you stayed and done it, it would have taken you probably another 30 minutes. I mean, I don't know how they calculate it.
It is weird to me that it's not spelled out and that, you know, Bo explains it after the fact. And in the U.S., they have to spell it out ahead of time. Like, it's game show law that you have to know exactly what's going to happen to you in any situation like that. So when you can't be surprised by a rule that you didn't know existed. And early seasons of the U.S. Amazing Race would assign you a time penalty for quitting specific types of tasks. But then also, if you broke a rule, it was typically like, how much time did you gain by breaking that rule? Mm-hmm. And you have to have that much time. Like if you took a taxi instead of walking, like, did it take you 30 mm-hmm. minutes it would have taken you 30 minutes longer to walk, so you get penalized 30 minutes. And they don't do that anymore, mostly because they're not really spelling out that sort of granular difference. But here, yeah, it's possible that they don't know. And that also makes it interesting because I got the feeling that Ronnie and Jobel had no idea what was going to happen when they checked in at the mat. But that could be just speculating.
Well, they certainly gave the task a red hot shot. So I don't know. I think they felt very much that they were going to be eliminated. And of course, we're absolutely thrilled when they weren't. And I think had they known it was 30 minutes, I think maybe they would have quit earlier. But it makes you wonder, because the Cowboys were looking for sugar tongs for nearly an hour and a half. So I wonder if they knew that the penalty for not finding your sugar tongs was 30 minutes, then they should have given up 30 minutes in. So it's not clear to me what they know, when they know it, and how the times are calculated.
Yeah, because you're almost at the point now in Amazing Race Canada where if you show up and it's a big pile of something looking for something even smaller, people are like, I'm not even going to touch it. I'm done. I'm out.
Yeah, they take 2 hours there if it's not. But in Amazing Race Canada, though, I think it's 4 if it's like a roadblock and nobody really quits detours. So, but yeah, here they do so many little tasks that it's like there's a lot of them. I mean, you could probably really go down the rabbit hole of going through every leg and being like, well, that would take a while and that would take a while. And that, I mean, it's not just the detours, it's all kinds of them. So I would think, I actually thought that maybe Jabel and Ronnie asked, because I mean, maybe they didn't and didn't know, because they did look kind of like they didn't know what was going to happen. But I think of it from a game perspective. If I was struggling, I mean, that they didn't even like, he was like facing the wrong direction and throwing it over his head, or I don't even know what they were doing. They didn't understand that she could pull him. But I just wonder, there has to be something, and I don't know if we'll ever get an answer. The only answer we'll get is in the future, because I mean, the last couple times we've had penalties was teams that were last, so they didn't, like Jordan and Violetta, when she couldn't make fire, you know, breathe fire. And then his swimming, they didn't tell us what that would have been. So it's hard to say what those were, because that was a roadblock for her, but they were last, so they just went and got, you know, sabotaged with the snorkels. So, you know, there's a lot of weird things that we don't really understand here, I think.
The other strange thing which struck me apparently is that you leave for the next leg in the order that you came in, but not at the time intervals that you came in, if you follow what I mean. So they are leaving at set time intervals, whether it's 5 minutes apart or 10 minutes apart or whatever it is, which has no relation to the time, intervals between the arrival on the mat. And I believe in the US, it is that time interval. So if I come in an hour behind you, I leave the next leg an hour behind you.
Well, that used to be how it is. Okay. It is unclear if that is still how it is.
Right.
I think there is some kind of room to fudge around with that a little bit. I don't think it's quite as pronounced as it is here, where it's almost like every beginning of every leg, there's a sign-in board. But I think when you're doing that many tasks on that tight a time frame, you have to do that. Because otherwise people are going to be 2 and 3 hours behind. And from a production standpoint, you have to have those tasks set up and you have to have a crew there for that long. I see why they do it. I think I'm surprised if the US version isn't doing this already, I'm surprised they're not.
Yeah, I think they also do it within legs, like you saw in the last leg where, I mean, this is not that uncommon for US, but I feel like there was almost a moment in every single leg where there was some sort of board, or like the two flights or the two boats, like in this time, or, you know, they're really trying to, you know, even had that one time where teams were all spread out and they had those really weird times where it was like 8 and 8:30 and 9:15. And like the times were strange. They weren't all even. And so I think they're trying a lot of ways, especially with there not being as much travel, like in terms of the airport is always the equalizer. They have a few airports, but I think they're trying to find ways to have it stay close, especially when you're doing not seven or eight things, but like 5 or 6 things. There's a lot of artificial things, but I feel like it's probably needed for this kind of show just in this country.
Yeah, with this many things and this many people, I think you really have to impose that on there. But here's something else that I'm finding fascinating that I don't think US Amazing Race would ever get around to trying. I want to talk about the first class pass, because this to me is kind of genius. If you have 24 legs and 14 teams, there's no way everybody's going to get to know them all. So why don't we just have some of the more visible teams sit out for a leg, and their reward is they can go to the spa while everybody else runs the leg. It's brilliant. And I kind of love it. I want to know if I'm alone on this.
I love the first class pass idea, especially I like that they combine it with the non-elimination leg. So like you have a race for first and it's not just about who gets the trip. It's about something else you gain. The only thing I don't like about it is, I mean, maybe it's results based. is the next leg where then that team draws from a bag. Cause there that leg I was watching and I'm like, where are they? They just weren't even showing them. And then all of a sudden we cut to the Sikhs picking 10th. And that was, if they hit that leg, if they had been U-turned, which was the correct move, if you were trying to get rid of the strong team, they would have been eliminated and it would have been because of the bag.
Yeah. Cosine on the U-turn, which we can get to. Yes, what I liked about the first class pass is this sabotage or salvage, which is it's a non-elimination leg, or as Bo tells us, a predetermined non-elimination leg.
John Montgomery does that too.
Just for all the fans out there, we already decided.
Phil did it in the first seasons too. Phil mentioned it was predetermined, in the early seasons.
But so it's a non-elimination leg, but it's not just, oh, the last person came in last, thought they were going to get eliminated. You know, Phil cocks an eyebrow or Bo just stops talking for a minute and then they find out that they're not eliminated. Joy, joy, joy. But it just adds now with this ability to be punished or rewarded and that power being given to a racer rather than production, I think is really interesting. And then what happens the next leg is you have the same number of teams you would have had there been an elimination. But the return into the game by drawing a placement is really dicey because the Super Sikhs drew 10 out of 12 teams, and they had to really hustle to regain their place. They only made it up to 8th, I think.
Yeah, but if you're that crowded together, I think it's less pronounced than if you're all leaving like 45 minutes apart.
True.
Yeah.
A good team can make that up.
Should we talk about salvage and sabotage?
Yes, please, because this is the wackiest thing. When they said sabotage and salvage, I was thinking like this must be more akin to like the salvage pass that we've seen on Australian Amazing Race or like the handicap that we've seen on Amazing Race Norway. And it's really not. It's a totally new thing, but it's so dumb. And I love how dumb it is.
I find the not talking thing I found just so ingenious. Because it led to so many weird moments with Jude and Shannon where she just kind of smiled and looked at her and couldn't talk. But oh my gosh, if they had just given that to Holly and Dolore, the wonders of what would have happened there. You know, I like that one more than the snorkel gear, which is funny for a minute, but then it's kind of like, oh yeah, they're wearing snorkel gear. Okay. So I find the sabotage though more interesting than the salvage. Which one was go to the front of the queue and then the other one with the guide, which didn't end up really helping them at all. But the sabotages are very fun, but the no talking to me is still one of the strangest ones I've ever seen.
It's like the Big Brother unitard of Amazing Race twists.
It's instead of a speed bump, is it? I think.
Yeah. Basically. Yeah.
But the diving mask and snorkel, it would have been very difficult and they were fogging up, but they also had to remove them because the mask would scare the turtles. So the production surely knew that, but no, the turtle mistress said, please take your masks off. You will scare the turtles. So do you think that, here's my question, in both cases now that we've seen the first class pass being given to the first to the mat and then being given the power to give the sabotage or the salvage to the last two arriving teams. Both times they've given the salvage to the second last and the sabotage to the last, explaining it as, oh, it's only fair because you came in last. Is this what we're going to see? Is no one going to use it strategically?
Oh, I 100% feel like if you know, I don't think it will happen, but if Holly and Dolore somehow lucked themselves into winning first place on one of these legs, you would definitely see them use it out of spite. And actually, if Holly and Dolore are one of the last two teams in another leg, like now that we've gotten to know them a little bit better, I think there are several teams that would deploy it out of spite.
I agree. I think we're going to see it because you narrow down the teams, that some of the teams are going to start to get sick, either get sick of other teams or realize this is the strongest team, we need to hurt them. Whereas so far, really, when you got down to it with the last two teams, with the Dancers and Jabal and Ronnie, I assume that most people like those teams and think they were the two strongest. So it was very easy for the girls to just say, we're going to go in order. But let's say we get to six or five teams and you look and you think, here's the strongest team. I think someone will get sabotaged. I think it'll happen, especially depending on who has it. If a team is just like, we're going to be nice to everyone, that's our thing. No. And some of the teams I have no idea because I don't know them. Like if Chris and Alicia get it, who knows? But, you know, it's still been, I think it'll happen sometime.
We can hope so.
Yeah. I think it's really hilarious that if you check in first and it's a non-elimination leg, they tell you up front, it's non-elimination, so you have to wait here. And they have to camp out there on the mat and watch everyone else check in. They just kind of stand there like, hey, what's up? It's really awkward and hilarious. So I also appreciate that part of it. But there are so many weird twists that I'm appreciating here. The Survivor Style Endurance Challenge, which I think we've talked about a little bit before, to determine the order of the next task. Do we like these little flares?
I don't know. I was very conflicted. I mean, for a start, everybody had left at intervals and then they had to all just run to Bo and then wait for everybody. So there was kind of this natural choke point that they'd put into the race. So I'm not sure why they didn't all leave together, but fine. There might have been something in there that we didn't see, but they're all going to end up on the beach and they're all going to have to wait for each other. I don't know. It's not very visually interesting watching people clinging on for dear life, although we did get the brilliance of Jessica just owning Delore. So for that alone, it was worth it.
Yes.
Dan, what do you think? I'm just that badly.
I don't know if this particular task, beyond, again, Delore like talking all this trash, then immediately Holly going out, which was great. But I don't know if this was it, but I like the idea. I like the idea of somehow there being an individual task that they compete in that is not just you leave when you're done, that there's somehow something else to it where everybody stops and watches. I think that is a setup for good drama and for something interesting to happen and to use different skills. Now, this one, of course, also knocked out Shane, which was sad, but I think there's potential. But again, it's kind of in that, like you mentioned with the Reddit person, kind of weird, amazing race think tank part of my brain that thinks there's got to be a way to make this better. But then also thinks, yeah, but it could also be worse. I don't know. So I'm a little conflicted.
It's kind of like a face off, but everybody's facing off at the same time.
True.
And I don't know how I feel about that. And I wonder also, are we going to see a face off or a head to head or a double battle? They're throwing everything else at the wall. I wouldn't be surprised to see it at this point.
Yeah, I think we might. Also, the weird thing I want to mention quickly, the U-turn where they require the team that's first to use it, which I had never seen
before.
That's
amazing.
Yeah, and the teams were really close. And again, Shane and Deb, I know why they U-turned Holly and Delore, who didn't understand. But if you really want to go by the JL rules, that was not the right team to U-turn. It was really one of the teams in the back, possibly a strong team. But making them do it, what do you think of that?
It was intriguing that they had, approaching the U-turn, they were in a shared taxi and they discussed it with, I can't remember who, but the other team that was there, and they all kind of agreed to it. So I think it was interesting that Shane and Deb kind of canvassed certainly at least one other team to get almost approval of who they were going to U-turn. I like them being compelled to U-turn. I love it. Absolutely love it.
I would kind of love to see a team arriving first at the U-turn board and being told you have to use the U-turn, and then like just waiting at the U-turn board and like standing right at the border and letting someone else go in front of them. Like, oh no, you go first. No, you go first.
I wondered about that. If a team would do that and be like, I don't really want to make any enemies. I don't really care. I need to tie my shoe. I don't know. Something like that. Just, I'm going to stop at the bathroom, something to just not get that, because I've never seen that before. And in fact, that it was a single U-turn in an elimination leg, it could have been very impactful.
Yeah, it absolutely could. I mean, thankfully, there's enough stuff on the back end of the leg that you could make up that time. Because, you know, U.S. Amazing Race would be like, this is a cool idea. And then they'd put it right by the mat.
Yeah, basically. It's like, who do you want to kick out completely? Have fun, yeah. Basically.
Had they U-turned the Super Six, who without the U-turn came in eighth, I mean, I don't know if it would have made them drop four places, but do you think they're the ones that should have been U-turned?
I think so. Yeah, go ahead, Jess.
Yeah, no, I think so as well.
They're the of all the teams that were near the back of the pack, if I look at where teams finished, I mean, you could take Holly and Delore out, who finished ninth. They were the obvious one. Also, if you look up to that point, they were first, and then didn't have to compete. So by that point, they were the only team that had finished first, and they even sat out a leg. But I think this early with this many teams aren't really thinking that way yet. Maybe they will down the road, though.
The JL rule is don't U-turn someone that you expect to see again.
Right.
I still think the Super Six were the ones to take the U-turn.
Me too.
I think with the teams that close together, I think they absolutely could have dropped four places very quickly. And I think that's one of the other things that's informing your strategic decisions right now is like, there's a lot of teams here. There's still a lot of room, like there's a lot of wiggle room, and you don't necessarily, I mean, Dan, you mentioned it already. It looks very different when there's five teams as opposed to when there's 10. And I think not only do you not know these people super well yet, but you don't necessarily have a slam dunk on every strategic choice.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So
will we see another U-turn, do you think?
Oh, of course. There's how many legs? We have 18 episodes left, Sarah. We're going to see everything. we're going to see like the event horizon.
Yeah.
Yeah. So perhaps it's that thing too. I mean, this is their first Amazing Race. They've all watched it, but they're actually in it now. And there's emergent strategy as they suss out the other teams, as they figure out their own strengths. I mean, I think Jessica just is getting stronger and stronger as she gains her confidence. Their placement has been fantastic. I'm sorry to go on and on and on about Sephora and Jessica, but
they're my favorite too.
And they were so good in the last most recent leg. So it's like fresh in the brain. They were so much fun.
And I will say that really applies globally to all of these teams at this point. I think this season so far, I mean, some of the tasks are extremely cheesy and they're the kind of thing if you're planning an amazing race in your own hometown, these are the kinds of things you'd make people do. But on the other hand, they are finding a lot of stuff that people never knew was in their wheelhouse. I think the fire breathing task in particular, you see Jackson just like completely, like he practically hit all three targets at once. And you see Chris do the same thing. It's like, how would either of them know that they were good at this? I think you're seeing such a wide variety of skills being tested that you might find something you didn't know you were good at.
Yeah, I agree.
Yes. And it's interesting because even our first detour, food or bev, where they had to peel 2 kilos of prawns, you would think, oh, every Australian knows how to peel prawns. But in fact, they don't. So we had some people who were prawn queens and some people who had a little trouble with the concept of removing the poop chute.
Yeah, I need Bo to stop saying poop shoot forever.
Yeah.
Over and over again. I just want to call out a couple other tasks that I really enjoyed. I mentioned the Dunny Derby already, but I have to mention the dancing one, which, I mean, a lot of that, you get a little in having all these teams dance, do these traditional dances is always kind of interesting. But some of them look so ridiculous, like the Shane and Delore doing the eagle dance. I was like, I couldn't help but laughing, even though I know that, I don't know, it gets a little hairy when you're talking about laughing at things that are, you know, important dances to people. But some of the challenges, or them snipping the grass with the little scissors.
Oh my God, I had flashbacks. At my school, if you were caught, you know, sitting on the field and absentmindedly pulling up grass, that was your next lunchtime.
Oh my gosh.
Cutting the grass with nail scissors.
This is a real Australian cultural thing.
Yep. I think somebody that's in production had that done to him or her, and they've now done that to the races. And it is really, it's as hard as you think it is. And it was as hard as they all decided that it was. I think with the dancers, it's interesting because I noticed that, not to bag on him too much, but it is so enjoyable. Delore, again, didn't watch the demonstration, and he wasn't doing what the boys showed him to do. And he was just doing, oh, it's an eagle, so I'll do an eagle. But it's not just an eagle. It's very particular movements, and they're very beautiful to do. I love the emu dance that the women were doing. What you will have may or may not have noticed is that the women's dances were being judged by the woman and the men's dances were being judged by the men. So mm-hmm. in Aboriginal culture, there's a separation of men's business and women's business, and that's part of the culture and part of the beauty. And the people who did really well were not necessarily dancers, but they were people who were giving attention to what they were being shown. And part of that is respect. And I found myself doing the emu head hand along with the women. And it's really beautiful to do. So I think the people who were not doing so well, Shane and Delore in particular, just decided they will do their version. Oh, it's just any old eagle, but it's right. not. It's a very particular dance. But again, we see that they're not, Delore and Holly were not that good at reading clues and following clues. In fact, when Holly opens up their salvage and reads out, you will be given the chance to go to the front of the queue in one instance. She puts down the clue and she says, babe, we can go to the front of the queue at any time. It's like, no, that's not what the clue said. It's not what you just said out loud.
Yeah.
Anyway, I will stop bagging on them, but I thought that was beautiful, and I loved seeing it, and I loved seeing them all wearing the ochre on their face as they did the rest of the leg.
Yeah, that was quite beautiful. I want to go back to the grass cutting for one second, just because I want to give a tip to those of you who are trying to balance like work and family and watching 4.5 hours of Amazing Race a week. Here's my tip. If you can download the episodes to your hard drive and open up VLC Player, you can watch them on 1.5 speed. And everything Delore does on 1.5 speed is even funnier.
Oh,
like there's a point where he's like, there are bugs jumping up at him and he's running away from them. And it was the best thing I saw all week.
Well, there's a lot. I mean, of course, there's the mouse trap in the boots, which is, again, yes, kind of one of the silly moments. I mean, there's more I could list. I don't want to turn this into a wow, that was awesome kind of game here. But there's through six legs and they do like six tasks a leg. It's there's a lot to cover. Do we want to talk about the thing that might be coming in the future? Do we want to talk about that?
I think we better. Sarah, what have you heard about this? Because I understand you're the one that brought this to us. You said you think this is what's going to happen.
Well, yes. So we have done our six legs in Queensland, and the next time on, they said, you know, a twist, and we have the racers gasping and being amazed. But we've all been, you know, we've all watched reality television before. We all know how we're being tricked by the, you know, upcoming events. But there is something called the T-junction. And it's like, they say, it's like a version of the intersection where teams had to team up until they were told not to team up. But it's like a mega intersection where I believe that the first team to arrive at the T junction will divide all the races in their teams into two mega groups. And those two groups will now complete the leg. Whichever group comes first is the one that comes first. And this is the thing we really have to talk about. The second super team to check into the pit stop has to decide which pair from their super team to eliminate from the race. Does your blood run cold?
It does. I hate it so much. I super hate it. I don't even care. Like, even if it's like Holly and Delore go out that way, I hate it. I want to kill it with fire.
Yeah, I mean, if they want that to happen, why don't they have those four teams compete in a challenge or something? Like, why do they're turning it into like Survivor, where it's like, what are they going to get? Bring out the urn and they all write names on a parchment or what? I think that's too much power to give. I mean, you're already having teams sabotage and salvage is a power, but at least that's one team and they're not effectively, because we saw the dancers survive. So it wasn't automatically eliminating them. Here, it just seems like if it's just a vote, that's ridiculous to me.
I hate it anytime they put voting in the Amazing Race. And we saw that two seasons ago on Amazing Race US, where Phil gathered everybody around and was like, okay, tell me who you would like to U-turn. And then it became this whole thing like, who did you say, like, did you say you were going to U-turn me? It doesn't matter that I didn't actually get U-turned. Why did you do that? And it, like, to put the stakes even higher on that is just unconscionable to me. It's not what this show is.
I hope that we are slightly misinformed and that the elimination is affected by something like the four teams then competing against each other, Dan, as you say. So I hope that our information is slightly faulty, but I fear that it's not. And one of my problems will be if it is Holly and Delore that go out, that they will always say, oh, it's because we were such a threat. Oh, it's because they were so jealous of us. Oh, it's because we're so good at everything. Rather than, you know, you were crap and you came last.
Yeah, they got beat by a bunch of rules.
Well, they got beaten by two mums to the mat.
Yes,
unfortunately, the mums did not have their backpacks.
Oh, so. Man, that killed me. Oh,
that was upsetting.
Killed me. Absolutely killed me.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, no, I was just going to say they got to the water slide first for the big finale and then failed. It was sad.
Yes. And the other thing about the water slide is that Holly wanted to see the manager. I don't know if you noticed. She's knocking on the glass. Can we go? Can we go? Can we go? I thought, oh, my God.
It was wonderful.
Yes. This is I want to see your supervisor. But I don't know whether there was a little bit of skullduggery bit there, but the mum certainly set off first on that water slide, and I was thrilled.
Yeah, it was very suspenseful in a way that I think Amazing Race frequently struggles to be that suspenseful.
Mm.
You would think like people are racing all the time, but you honestly did not know from that point on who was actually going to get there. And I liked that a lot. I want to spend a little more time on the washing the turtle tank and feeding the sea turtle.
Oh, yes.
Because that was the coolest challenge that we've seen on this season so far. And I think the coolest challenge I've seen on a season of The Amazing Race in quite some time. It was a fun experience. It was local, but it also felt big. Like if International Amazing Race came there, they would still do that same task, right?
Yes, I think some of the tasks have felt very homemade in our backyard. This is how we would do it. But that was very much a prime task. And they were so, almost all the teams were so delighted to be there. They seemed actually interested in the facility, which is to rehabilitate hurt sea turtles. So rather than just doing the task, they were also kind of intrigued by how does it work and who are the turtles and who are the people. And they had clearly found out the people who worked there's names, as several of them thanked them by name. And I thought that made it really interesting as well, that while they were going hell for leather to finish the task, they also seemed like really engaged in the work of the facility.
Yeah, you frequently see people on this program, on various global iterations of this program, treating the people that are managing the tasks like their furniture and not really taking the moment to find out what they're about. And so I did like those moments of human connection we've seen throughout the race so far.
Yeah, I prefer that too, because then too, it's like the last thing you have those moments where the tasks are really hard. But I don't need to ever see teams just dig in dirt or dig in sand again in my life on The Amazing Race. To me, that's just not interesting. It's like, oh, it's going to be hard. And then they're going to be like, this is so hard. And then it goes on where this is something. Yeah. Where it's like, it feels like, again, Jess, you've used the example about the stuff that might be in your local quick, easy, Amazing Race. This doesn't feel like that. This feels like something that's, they're going to talk about this and enjoy it. rather than just being, well, we've got to do 5 or 10 minutes, so let's have teams do this. It might be funny because it's really hard. It's different. And almost everyone did it, even teams waiting for it. And then, of course, it was just fun to see that. And rather than everyone drowning or getting freaked out, though I did enjoy that because Jess succeeded, but just a fun task.
Yeah. So I have a final segment I want to do, but before we get to that, are there any other facets of this that we want to discuss?
The only other one I would say would be Alex and Jack quitting. And again, I'm not going to speculate at all because I don't know. I mean, it sounds like something very serious that came up from his past, but just the fact how it impacted the race, the fact that they were a strong team that finished near the top, and then immediately something came up at the start of the second leg and they had to quit. And then, of course, that led to Joez and Catherine coming back. But I just figured that's something we should mention just because, you know, it was a real surprise. You could tell Bo was very surprised. You know, he wasn't just hugging them and saying it'll all be okay. There was obviously something really there. And it was just quite, you know, after seeing them in the first leg and then they were gone, it was like, whoa. And it was just, it was something very interesting. And I just hope everything's okay for them. But them being out so quickly for something completely apart from the race.
Yes, they were a very strong team. They came in second to the Super Six. And the description that they gave was that they were on sort of cloud nine, but that because of the lockdown, the two-week lockdown beforehand, and it's something from their shared past, we don't want to know, it's not up to us to know, but that one had sought help and the other hadn't. I looked at an interview of them, I think, a few weeks afterwards, sort of still shaky, but very that lovely brotherly love that you saw between them when they were describing with Jack, in fact, describing that that this had happened and that they were withdrawing. And on the mend, I think, would be the headline there. But both times, both in the television program as we saw it and in this interview that I saw, they were emphasizing mental health being important.
Yeah, and I like that the show dealt with this very sensitively because I think, you know, reality television as a genre globally has not always had the best track record with how it treats people that decide that the experience is not for them for whatever reason. And I thought this was handled very sensitively. And also, again, because they've got 24 legs to play around with, they were able to bring another team back, which I think because they're not so stuck to a schedule in the same way that you would if you had exactly as many legs as you did teams with room for a couple of non-eliminations, I think they have room to see what happens if we do this. And I think I'm not going to be too results oriented about this, but I did like that we were able to bring a team back, and that you're not just the first one out and the next team quits. So it's like they could have quit and you could have still been in it.
Yes, and Dwayne and Catherine have been sort of improving as well. They finished fourth in the sixth leg, so I think they're feeling their strengths as well.
And it takes them. I think how many times have we seen a team go out early or someone get voted out early of Survivor where we thought, man, if they just had a couple more days to get their bearings, how awesome would they have been? And I think we're seeing that now. And I'm happy about that. And also that they didn't feel like they were just doing it at the expense of Alex and Jack. They said, you know, this is the decision that's right for them. And now let's continue the race and we won't bag on them for not hacking it or anything like that.
I think it was very much presented as a strength that Alex and Jack were showing strength to withdraw. Yes. And I liked that framing.
Yeah, I did as well. I think I hope that helps people for sure. So now to bring it into a little bit of a lighter area, Sarah, I know one thing that you were very passionate about when we discussed doing this podcast is you wanted to make sure that we were able to understand some of the cultural nuances and slang terms that are being thrown around here. And so I wanted to offer I'm going to offer my top three Aussie slang terms that I have learned from watching this season of The Amazing Race.
And excellent.
Yes, you may certainly feel free to bring your own to the table as well. Anything that you want to explain to the non-Aussies out there, I'm sure we would all appreciate it. But I learned the term dunny, which is the term for an outhouse or other outdoor toilet facility. And of course, we got to see dunnies on full display in this season of the race. And I hope that wasn't really dunny water. I have to imagine that's a public health hazard. You'd get E. coli if that was real toilet water on your head.
It's blue. That's just the sort of water that treated water that would be in a porta
like potty.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm sure that it was a clean, shall we say. Now here, there was an involvement of not only an involvement of locals, but an acknowledgement of an interaction with locals, because the teams had to draw a dunny along, and inside the dunny were some previous Dunny Derby champions.
Oh, that's how they
were
picked
champions,
those people.
Really?
Yes,
wow.
Yes. One of them said, one of them told the Cowboys, "You're pulling a four-time champion."
I love that challenge so much, and I totally missed that. I also, one of the teams had a bigger guy that slowed them down a bit, which, I mean, just the unused clean toilet water on the head in like the little bedpan is just, it's so Amazing Race Australia. That's the only way I could put it.
It was, but what was sort of delightful about it is that there was skill, because they had the bedpan strapped to the top of a helmet on their head, and they had to then pour it into a container. So there was actually some skill there too, as we saw, because a certain person whose name rhymes with Malore just dumped all his water without waiting for Holly to give him any instruction, and then he spat the dummy, and then he took the bedpan off his head and made her wear it. And it was a whole delicious moment.
It was a thing. And imagine being the production assistant that had to hot glue all of those bedpans onto bicycle helmets. What a world. What a job.
What else did you like of ours?
I learned the term Lilo for an inflatable raft device. That was something new to me. Where does that come from?
I don't know the etymology. I'll give it a quick Goog, but Lilo, yes. I've actually been carried out to sea as a child on a Lilo. I remember looking back to my mother standing on the shore looking very worried. But Lilo, I will look into that while you tell us what it is that you like about it. Is it the sound of the word? Do you just like saying it?
Yeah, it's a new term for something, and I love it when people are just using a term for something that we have a totally different understanding of what that thing is called, and everyone's like, oh yeah, that's a Lilo. And they just kept using it. It even took me a second to figure out what they were even talking about.
So it's spelled L-I-L-O, and I'm seeing here it's a trademark. So it would have been a brand.
It's like a Kleenex.
Yeah, or a Hoover or a fridge. Yeah, it's from the – yeah, but we just call them Lilos. What do you call them?
Oh, we just call them rafts, I guess. Dan, what would you call that?
Yeah, I think that's all. I don't really have another great name for it. It just, you know, or that boat or something. Or not really boat, but that thing. I guess raft is probably the best. That thing. Yeah. Some great podcasting for me, but yeah, I would say raft. Yeah.
Will you be calling it Lilo from now on?
Of course.
Might try to make that happen. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And finally, I have heard this before, but I love the word legend used as an interjection to mean awesome or cool. And I think the Cowboys in particular like the use of legend, and it's just like, I wish I could start doing that, but it would feel appropriative, and I don't think it would have the same panache coming from a displaced Midwesterner living in New York. You know what I'm saying?
You could try it. It's usually applied to a person, and if you want to give it a bit more oomph, and they're even better than a legend, then there'll be a dead set ledge. So they're a dead set legend or dead set ledge. You could try that as well. We like it. Legend.
Legend. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I had those all those written down. I was going to see if you'd pick them up and whether you liked them.
Yeah, you could do the Phil Kogan thing where you give me slang terms and make me define them.
Oh, sure. I just got a few that I wondered whether you'd pick them up and whether you knew what they were, but they're all from context. He was giving you ones that hadn't necessarily been used in the show, the ones that I wrote.
Yes.
No, not that I'm better than Phil Kogan, who liked a tweet of mine the other day and I was completely excited. Yes, I've written, I noted a few down. Dan, was there anything that you were puzzled by or delighted
well,
by?
Well, can I ask a question about the Weet-Bix a little bit?
Yes.
Because I assume Weet-Bix was not a sponsor, because if they were, they did not get their money's worth. So I assume Weet-Bix, I've looked it up. It's like a breakfast cereal, you know, and it's been around since the 1920s. And I promise I won't read the Wikipedia page to everyone. But so is this something that a lot of people eat that they enjoy? Like if you added milk to it and maybe a little fruit, would it be like on the level of like a healthy cereal here? Or is this something that's just rarely eaten that they that no one had really had?
Well, Dan, I want to throw in, I think a Weet-Bix is like shredded wheat in the U.S., which nobody really eats. But I think the cultural comparison is not apt, but I think the actual physical comparison is. I when I see it, I think of shredded wheat.
Well, I can say to you both that Aussie kids are Weet-Bix kids. Aussie kids are Weet-Bix kids. Weet-Bix are really wonderful. I love them. Some people don't like them. So it's basically wheat, salt, and water flaked, squashed into a sort of biscuit thing. One of the ad campaigns that they run is that idea of how many do you do, and then you get sports stars to smash out 8 for breakfast or whatever it might be. But they absolutely have to have something on them. They're a carrier. So they're a carrier for milk or fruit or sugar or whatever you want to put on them. But a lot of people, myself included, will just put butter and Vegemite on them. So use them like a fat cracker. But they are quite wonderful, and they're a very common breakfast item. Eating 20 dry would be absolute hell, as we saw some teams really struggling, particularly the poor Cowboys. I couldn't believe it, because of course they were seen as favorites for smashing, as we would say, smashing 20 Weet-Bix. But yes. Try it. You'll like it.
Okay. That's my only question. That's all I
all
got.
Right. Well, I've got a couple of things for you. Did you hear the Cowboys in particular using the phrase spewing? Do you know what spewing is?
Yes.
I assumed it meant like vomiting.
It does mean vomiting, but it also then metaphorically can mean, oh, did you see her, take my seat? I was spewing. So you could be spewing I was angry about it. So
you can be vomiting anger.
You can
as
be
well
vomiting
as vomit.
Anger. Yes. Now they had to carry schooners of beer. I don't know what size of beer you guys are used to, but I've got a few different sizes. You can have a pony, a 7, a midi, a schooner, a butcher, a pot, a handle, a 10, a pint. So we kind of like our beer in all different sizes.
Now, be real, Sarah. Do you really know all of those beer sizes off the top of your head? Or did you make a list?
I made a list because I thought I'll just get nervous and I won't be able to. I used to drink ponies, but in different states, they're called different things. But yes, I knew them all except Butcher. I'm not familiar with Butcher. That comes from Adelaide and they're very strange in South Australia. So thank you. And the other one I thought you might like was mad as a box of frogs, which Bo said.
Well, that one I've heard.
Yeah.
And also cane toads as a cultural thing in Australia. Mm-hmm. There's a very famous documentary that they make biology students watch in the U.S. about the invasive species. Like the best thing to comprehend what an invasive species is and does is the cane toad movie.
Yes.
So. We knew all about that. And mad as a box of frogs, I think I have heard both in conjunction with the cane toad movie and like in Australia larger.
Yes. Mad meaning crazy, insane. And speaking of cane toads and bow, I think it's interesting. I mean, we have come to bow, and as we should, we do need to discuss him. I think the show knows how clumsy he is, not just physically, but also socially and televisually. Because they left in the bit where he was doing the introduction to the cane toads, standing in a pen of cane toads with bare feet, and he had to scream and jump out of the pen and then take the introduction again. They left in the take one where he screamed and jumped out. And I thought, yes, they know if he has appeal, it is in his very unsuitability to do this job. What do you think of Bo?
I think he's a dweeb, but I also think that he's really more closer on the spectrum of Amazing Race hosts. He's very much closer to John Montgomery. I feel like he's taking his cues as a host from John rather than from Phil or from his predecessor, Grant Bowler, in the sense that he is along for the adventure and he is, you know, he's doing all of the tasks along with them, and they kind of, he wants to be their buddy. And I think Phil maybe started out, and I know from speaking to many racers that the experience off camera is that Phil really is their buddy and he does hang, but you don't see that on TV. There is a separation. But with Bo, it's like, you can tell he just walks into the pit stop and like starts handing out drinks, which is a different experience as a host. But he also has absolutely zero gravitas, which is also a complete 180 from Grant Bowler. So he can't handle those serious moments in the way that I think even John Montgomery, if somebody got medevaced, he'd be able to walk in and like explain it to everybody else without looking like a buffoon.
Buffoon, that's such a good word. And it's what he is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about you, Dan? Where are you at? Where are you with Bo?
You know, I mean, he's sloppy and he's kind of all over the map, and he's like, but he's a little endearing. I almost feel like though he's the right host for this show, for this version. Like in a way, John Montgomery is the perfect host for Canada, because he's like, I love Canada. I was an Olympian. Canada's me. Let's make Canada proud. And you're like, yeah, John, I want to make Canada proud. And Phil's
Canadian.
Yeah, I'm not Canadian, but I still do. Phil's a little more like, you know, look at all this culture, everyone. We should really take in how amazing this trip is. It's really cool. And I know he's different off camera, but this to me is more on, and I'm trying not to just repeat what both of you have said, but there's a little bit of this kind of like, can you believe they just let me do this? And there's a little bit that with the show too, where they do some tasks. So like, well, this is kind of crazy. We're doing the Amazing Race. Why don't we make them do that? And I think he's fits that, because if you had a really serious host and he's like, our next task is you're going to cut grass with scissors, and he kept like, was Grant Bowler saying that? I'd be like, there's something off here. But having him laying on the ground doing it, I'm like, yeah, that kind of fits. So and the hugging is, we talked about that a bit. But it doesn't matter if they're happy or sad or whatever. He just loves going in for the hugs. You know, I've never, last season too, it's kind of endearing. And then also it's like, is there somebody who just doesn't want to hug Bo? I don't know. I guess they get one anyway.
Yeah. Step off. I'm not a hugger. You're right, Dan. I think he's more successful on this season than he was on the previous season. The previous season, he struggled to fit the tone, because it was really very much a restaging of American Amazing Race, or even of previous Australian Amazing Race. But this is such a different animal, and he's really the right guy for this particular animal.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, a couple of things. One is it's his second season, so he's more loose. I do find him endearing. I mean, that someone is so unsuitable for the task and yet just does it. And I do like that. I remember a just very cringy moment last season where he was looming at 6'1" over a very small Thai woman, and his small talk with her was, "Do you have any children?" And she just stared ahead and didn't answer. And he went, "Hmm," and I thought, "Oh dear, that's no good." But here he's enthusiastic. He does all the tasks, which is good, including, you know, being frightened of cane toads. And Yes, his only misstep was he didn't really know how to deal with Shane's injury, and so kind of banged on the ambulance and said, "Right, oh no, let's on with it, onward," you know. But I think you're absolutely right. He suits this season particularly. I think he's got more relaxed and is more just his, we would say, daggy self. And I think it is a good match. Just stop hugging people. Stop it.
Yeah, we have a pandemic, and it was not cool before the pandemic. It's definitely not cool now.
Yeah.
Yeah, not okay. So I think that about brings us to the end of this. I think we did very well to recap 6 episodes of a show in an hour and a half. And obviously this pace is unsustainable for regular podcasting, but we would love to hear from you if you got all the way to the end of this and you really need to hear more. I would love to get a tweet from everybody letting us know that you're happy and you'd like to hear more from us. And so we may be able to bring you something at the end of the season. No promises, but we can try. And I'd really love to know what you all think of this season so far. So please get in our mentions and let us know how that's going. You can find me on Twitter at Haymaker Hattie. And Sarah, where are you?
I'm on Twitter at Sarah Carradine.
That's easy enough. And Dan, of course, where are you?
I am at the Dan Heaton. And also, if you like theme parks, you can follow me there tomorrow, SOC. And I have to mention, related to that, that they want a trip to Disneyland in the last leg, yep, and it's closed. Sorry, guys.
Yes.
You can't go.
Well, they can't go anyway because they can't leave the country.
We can't leave
that
the country.
Too. No, I assume Disneyland will open before they can leave the country. So probably not a big deal.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fine, Dan. They'll be able to cash that in whenever. You know, everybody on U.S. Amazing Race is sitting on trips they want as well. Like, I think Will and James have like 3 and they're like, we'll take it eventually. Not in a hurry. But yeah, I liked the subtle product placement in that leg as well. I was looking at the janky map with Nemo on it. I'm like, is Disney going to sue them? Because that doesn't look authorized. And then they open the chest and Nemo pops out.
Yeah.
And then at the end, they gave away a Disneyland trip. So I'm like, I'm just going to assume the mouse is okay with this.
You would hope.
We'd hope so.
Yeah, we hope. I don't want anybody getting sued. No. So Sarah, tell us what else you're working on. I know you've got you've been doing a lot around the RHAP and PSR universe.
Yes. Well, I'm kind of Mrs. Quiz Show now suddenly, which is great. I've been writing some quizzes for Jordan Kalish for Twish, which has been enormous fun. And I got together on the, for the Post Show Recaps patrons with Sasha Joseph, Geneva Guadalupe, and Kirsten McInnes to recap the first 4 episodes of Bridgerton, and that's dropping on Valentine's Day. And we're going to get together and recap the second 4 as well. So that's been really fun.
I'm excited. I'm going to have to, again, the nice thing about being able to watch things on sped up is I could probably get through all 4 of those episodes of Bridgerton before the podcast drops.
It's a good idea too, because we don't follow the linear plot. We kind of do what we've done today, which is one thing leads to another. And we just did quite a large general discussion. And it was lots of fun and very intriguing and different ideas came out. So I hope people will listen and enjoy.
Very excited to check that out. And Dan, what are you up to lately?
Well, of course, I am sitting at home hoping that we get something similar with Amazing Race Canada this summer so that we can podcast about that. But in the meantime, I do a show outside of RHAP called the Tomorrow Society Podcast, where I talk to a bunch of people that have worked on theme parks. I'm doing a lot of former Imagineers right now, and so that's really exciting. And you can learn all about that at tomorrowsociety.com. It's really fun.
Good stuff, Dan. And I have to say, it has awakened a curiosity in me that I did not know I had. When you start talking to all these Imagineers, like, I'm very in the weeds on the behind the scenes at Disney stuff, the way I didn't know was possible. So I have the Tomorrow Society to thank for that. And as for me, I am quite busy over on the post-show recap side of things these days. Rob Cesternino and I are just about to wrap up our coverage of CBS All Access series based on Stephen King's The Stand. And that has been a ride, let me tell you what. We will be very happy to get off the ride and proceed to the exit after this week. And then around that time is when Walking Dead picks up. So we will be bringing you coverage. Brandon Chappelle and I will be on that with occasional special guests when that premieres on February 28th. And of course, this week, we've been talking about Phil Kogan this whole podcast, and I would be remiss if I did not mention that tonight we are recording this on February 10th, which is the premiere date of season 2 of Tough as Nails. And of course, Mike Bloom and Rob Cesternino and I will be getting together very shortly to talk about everything that happened on there. And throughout the season, like, who knows what can happen on a Tough as Nails podcast, because I will tell you, season 1, a lot of stuff happened I didn't think would ever happen and I could not have imagined in my wildest dreams. So I hope that you all will tune in for that. And so I think that brings us to the end of our podcast. And if you like what you hear, let us know and we'll see what else we can think about bringing you, because 18 more episodes seems like a lot and we're probably going to have a lot of opinions on it. But in the meantime, I want to thank you again, Sarah, for joining us. You are, as they say, dead set ledge.
Oh, good as gold.
Excellent. And of course, Dan Heaton, as always, it is a pleasure to talk Amazing Race with you. And I'm glad we didn't have to wait for John Montgomery to get his stuff together in order to do it.
Thank you, Jess. This was awesome.
All right. And so I think that's it for us. We will see you on the flip side or something. I'm terrible at ending podcasts, but have a great week, guys.